Can I get away with the same jokes, or do I have to write more?
You definitely can. I will not remember
them. You'll remember them? Okay, perfect. All right, so thank you so much for coming out. I just want to share with you, as I did the last time I was here, not only am I speaking here, which I'm very excited to do, I am an alum of Taurus MS. That is me with the very cool pants over there. I don't remember her name. I had Maura Judy Neufeld in kindergarten.
She's my
friend. Yeah, Maura Bistacki. Maura Bonnie, Miss Bonnie.
No.
Well, Heshy Glass was the principal at the time.
Yes.
Okay.
Very well.
Okay, yeah, well.
That's great.
So, just by a raise of hands, how many of you think we're here to talk about the internet and internet safety? Don't be shy, okay? Yeah, okay. So what I want you to do is I want you to change your paradigm, because it's not just about internet, it's about how technology impacts us, right? So it's not just about the internet, per se, which is really about content, but it's our relationship with technology. We are inundated with technology, whether it's smartphones or a screen, any screen, the devices, the watches. We are completely inundated with technology, and that really impacts our lives in significant ways. By raise of hands, how many of you experience what we call phantom vibrations? That's when your body vibrates, and it's just me and the guy in the back. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Your body's vibrating, but your phone's not around. That just gives you an idea of how significant technology is, where our literally we do not know where our bodies end and the technology begins. The reality is that 89% of people experience phantom vibrations, which is quite remarkable when we think about it. It's so inundating part of our lives. And one of the things that I talk about when it comes to technology is we want to think about technology and our relationship with it. Is it an enhancement in our lives, or is it an intrusion in our lives? And the answer for all of us is sometimes it's an enhancement, sometimes it's an intrusion. And by engaging in strategic, thoughtful, and deliberative practices when it comes to technology, we can shift that barometer more towards an enhancement and less of an intrusion. And that's really what the goal is. So I created a program called the Digital Citizenship Project, which is, when we started it, Barack Obama was president, so people thought it was a pathway to U.S. citizenship using the internet. So you used to get calls, oh, how can I become a citizen? But no one thinks that under Trump. There's been no confusion whatsoever. But digital citizenship are the norms of appropriate and responsible behavior when it comes to technology. So that's what we want to think about, is like, what is our relationship, what is our role? I speak to students all the time, I say, what does it mean to be a citizen? Well, as a citizen, we have certain rights, we have certain responsibilities, and the same applies to technology. We have rights and responsibilities, responsibilities towards others, and responsibilities towards ourselves as well. A friend of mine took this picture at a wedding as he was walking down the aisle. I'm looking at your faces. Some of you are horrified that this would happen, and others, it looks like you think it's a pretty good idea. And you're like, why didn't I think of that? I could do that. Save it a photographer at the wedding. This guy liked it so much, he recently got remarried for the second time, and he did it at his own chuppah. So what are those standards when it comes to technology, right? We haven't really defined it. We're in this age of flux where we've been inundated with technology, and we're not really sure how we are setting up the rules, parameters, and guidelines. A lot of times parents are looking for what we call the magic pill. The magic pill is, what device should I get? What filter should I get my child? What age is the perfect age for my child to get a device? What's the exact amount of screen time that will allow my child to be healthy without them being a zombie, right? Finding that balance. And these are very, simple questions for a much more complex problem or a much more complex challenge. And so we have to think about technology more as a complexity, and there's an article in the back there in defense of complexity, than it is a simple solution. I often say we live in the best of times, we live in the worst of times. The line actually goes, Charles Dickens writes, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. So I really think that if we ever lived in a time currently, the age of wisdom, the age of foolishness, that's what we live in. It's tremendous opportunity that technology brings, but it's also tremendous challenge that it presents as well. Technology offers us some amazing things: accessibility, productivity, information, connectivity. I really feel like I currently relate to the connectivity piece more than I ever have in my life. I have a daughter who's in Eretz Yisrael for the year, and I know what you're thinking is, how can a guy so young have a daughter in Eretz Yisrael? And the answer is moisturizer. So, no, but the truth is, it's an amazing thing that she can be in Israel. and I can FaceTime with her and speak. But we also, it creates challenges in the sense that the whole idea of spending a year in Israel is not to be tethered to home, is to have that experience of independence and developing those skills. The IDF did a study not too long ago where they were looking at entry-level soldiers, and they found that there was a failure to develop leadership skills. And one of the concerns was that they were finding that the soldiers' mothers were texting the commanding officers saying, be nice to my boy. Don't make him run too hard. Make sure he waits a half hour after eating before, you know, swimming or something like that. And not only that, the soldiers themselves were texting the commanding officers. Every individual mundane question, they would send a text to the commanding officer, and so they would never go through that process of cognitive evaluation of a challenge, projecting what the outcomes might be, making good decisions and feeling good about it, making bad decisions and learning from those experiences. And so we are creating a generation that does not have the grit and resilience necessary to succeed for adverse conditions because technology has. So best of times, accessibility, productivity, information, connectivity. Worst of times, we see challenges in the social, behavioral, psychological, and day-to-day realms. And also, I was speaking to a few parents in the developmental realm as well for early child. How many of you have preschoolers, just so I get a feel? So I'll touch on preschool a little bit as well and what we're seeing in that. So the first thing is, how many of you are like me that you love technology? Don't be shy. Technology is awesome. It's amazing. I love it. In fact, the UN did a study a few years ago where they found that 6 billion out of the world's 7 billion people owned a mobile phone, but only 4.5 billion have a toilet. So when you think about the priorities, you know, what we think about, right? Only, right? Where are the priorities? A lot of people will say, well, you can't trust the United Nations. They don't, you know, things they put out. But the reality is technology is really a driving force. We also have a generational disconnect. You ever get the feeling like your children know more about technology than you do? Right? There, it's a digital. I like this text between a mother and child. Your great aunt just passed away, LOL. Why is that funny? It's not funny, David. What do you mean? Mom, LOL means laughing out loud. Oh my goodness, I sent that to everyone. I thought it meant lots of love. You're laughing, but you've all been there where you misunderstood the lingo, right? Everybody knows what FOMO is?
Yeah.
What? Excellent. We have a bilingual group. I like that. I thought in Miami they spoke English and Spanish, but you also speak English, Spanish, and digital, which is wonderful. What?
Missing out.
Fear of missing out. Okay, he's only bilingual, not trilingual. All right. Fear of missing out. But by the way, fear of missing out is not just a thing. It's But it drives. No, it's good. I like we have a small, we can be interactive. But it really, FOMO is what drives kids. That is what drives kids' desire to have things. We're going to see that a little later in a later slide. But one of the things that we can do, and I think one of the goals of today is to walk out of here where we can influence the social norms within a community, particularly a school community or a grade community, where the FOMO is diminished. If we, for, I'll give you an example. I don't like to say the answers, but if we can influence a 6th, 7th, and 8th grade grouping to say, we don't want a smartphone, right? It only becomes, the demand for the smartphone only becomes because kids have a smartphone. So in partnership with a school where you can set policies and create a social norm where the kids aren't saying, but everyone has, but so we can actually influence. That's the power of small groupings. And the best part about speaking in yeshivas and yeshiva communities is we overall we have the pretty much the same goals in mind for our kids. I mean, there's always nuanced differences, but we can influence that. So we see this generational disconnect. Our kids know more. I do think we are fortunate as adults, the age that we are. There are certain things we know that our kids do not know. They do not know what this is, right? They don't know what this is. In Chabad, they tell me it's a pushka, so I don't know. They certainly don't know the relationship between these two items. I'm looking, I see some of the younger parents don't know either. I'm gonna turn to someone older, they'll explain it. Rabbi Palagon, you know what this is, right? Yeah, okay.
You gotta write the name on the...
right, exactly. So we actually collected some data from the school community. A number of the parents filled out surveys, the students filled out surveys. I wanna share with you some of that data today. What we found was in the middle school, 29% of kids owned a smartphone.
In this one?
This middle school, yeah, 29% of kids owned a smartphone. So by the way, so it's very helpful. It's very helpful. This is what the kids said, by the way. This is what the kids said. It's very helpful to know what the real numbers are. And, you know, I know that when schools are approaching policy and thinking about how they want to address some of the technology challenges, the data actually becomes very important. 74% of kids reported that they owned an internet-capable device, meaning a Kindle, an iPad, like an iPod. Sometimes kids will think that the old iPhone sitting around the house that's left over, the old iPad that no one really uses or that you forgot about because you upgraded your phone 3 times since the iPhone 5, they think it's theirs. So it's important to keep in mind, because when we're talking about technology, we're not just talking about your individual child's device ownership, right? So theoretically, 29% own, you know, their own device. But it's really the environment and their access. So 99% of the kids reported that they have access to devices at home. So whether they own it, whether they don't own it, whether they're holding on to it for you in case you need it one day, whatever the variables are, their access is there. So I wouldn't get caught up in the ownership per se, because that can easily be addressed. But what is the overall technology environment at home? Social media, these are the 3 top social media apps used by kids today. Snapchat, WhatsApp, and Instagram. I really don't recommend Snapchat or Instagram for any of your kids. I would be very wary if they come and tell you that everybody has it. Both Instagram, the content available on Instagram is extremely problematic. And Snapchat, by design, was made for something that we call disinhibition they take like a high road approach. We want people to feel comfortable in their skin to be able to express themselves, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that it really is promoting negative behaviors. WhatsApp is something that is commonly used amongst families and generally is the least problematic of the social networks that people are using, but also should be something that should be very thoughtful and approaching it very carefully when you are allowing your child to be part of a group. Again, at this age, what we see a lot is, let's say there's a camp chat or even a grade chat. Many parents will allow it to be on their device, but then your child is always, you know, asking you for your device, and then they have your device, and hours later they still have your device. So these are things to keep in mind as well. 44% of the kids said they're active users of social media, not necessarily using their own accounts or their devices. They could very well be using your, it could be speaking on family chats. But the fundamentals around that, the behavioral concerns that we see, it's almost irrelevant whether it's their own device. The frequency might be less if it's your device, but the behaviors that we see around technology and the dependent type of relationships that kids develop with technology around that as well in social media, et cetera. Gaming, your kids like video games? Yes? Yes, every kid likes video games. 83% of your kids reported being active users of digital gaming, and 18% reported playing Fortnite, in case you were wondering about that. So, Fortnite, 18%. 18% reported playing Fortnite. And Fortnite is really not geared towards the 12 and under crowd or the 13 and under crowd. It's an amazing thing. 35% of Fortnite playing kids have skipped school to play Fortnite, right? But what's even more remarkable, just to show you the dependence that it promotes, 20% of Fortnite playing adults have skipped work to play Fortnite. So just to give you an idea, so if 20% of adults can't regulate their own behavior around it, how can kids, middle schoolers, who don't have yet developed a strong sense of self-regulation, how do we expect them to manage it as well? Actually, here's an example of a kid who plays Fortnite, and this is what happens. Just note that there was a tornado, and there's a truck upside down behind him, just so you see the scenario, and here is the interview with the news. So I'm just going to switch the audio to the speaker. Give me 1 second, please. Give me 1 second. Sound. Headphones. All right, that should work. Let me just test that. There we go. Okay. So we see Fortnite and other games being extremely play from your own side. Being extremely addictive, but it's not just Fortnite. It's a lot of the games they're reinforcers. And we need to think of video games in terms of not just the content, right? So certainly, you know, we have a whole spectrum of types of video games. Let's just say on the most extreme problematic side from a content standpoint would be games like Grand Theft Auto or Assassin's Creed or Call of Duty. These are extremely violent games. Then you have games like Fortnite, which are sort of role-play fantasy games that have elements of violence in it. And then you have, let's say, sports, you know, or Lego-type games. And then you have, you know, like Minecraft-type games, right? So that's like the spectrum of content. So assuming...
Hello.
So assuming...
Mario.
Where does it fall in? I don't know. Are you comfortable with the content? I think Mario's content's fine. But again, that's a personal value. I don't want to impose my values on you. I think from a content standpoint, it's okay. But if your child's playing 6 hours a day of Mario, that's... It's not about the content, it's about the behavior. I actually had a parent come over to me saying that a math teacher sent home a math game for a child to play, right, to practice their multiplication tables or something. And they sent and he said, wow, this is great. They can, like, learn multiplication and play a game at the same time, which was fine. Content-wise, it's fine. But then, you know, when the child was playing the game 3-4 hours later, behaviorally, that's a problem. So we have to think of gaming in terms of two things. One, the content. And two, the actual behavior dependence, compulsivity that is related to the gaming itself. So those are the things that we want to be concerned about and set limits with. So we had a high percentage of kids that reported playing video games. We also had a high percentage of kids that reported watching videos. With YouTube being the number one, 71% of kids used YouTube, 60% used Netflix, and 14% used Amazon Prime. Each one has its own challenges. YouTube, it's certainly more difficult to control the content in YouTube because anytime a video comes up, it has 18 different suggested videos, which might not be the video that you actually put on for your child. There are restriction settings within YouTube. But again, think about it in terms of we have the content issue and then we have the behavioral issue, right? So assuming the I like to tell this story. I was at the Agoda convention a couple of years ago, and there's a nice Hasidic couple pushing their 2-year-old around in the stroller, and the child was sitting there with the Twins from France on a DVD player. Everybody knows the Twins from France? It's these acrobat twins that they're from France. And they do acrobatics and stuff. Anyway, the content, I would say, is fine, right? So I saw this couple pushing the 2-year-old with the DVD player, and then I saw 3 hours later... They're still pushing this kid with the 2-year-old with the stroller with the DVD player watching the Twins from France. And so I think the obvious question arises is where do you get such good battery life out of a DVD player? That's, I mean, obvious. But then the second question is they don't realize, because the content is okay, they don't realize the problematic developmentally and a whole host of issues that they're creating by allowing their child to watch 3 hours of the Twins from France. So we need to think of in more, when we talk about the complexity of technology, it's not just about the content. The content's an issue, and the behavior is an issue. So we need to think about these in terms of more complexity. So gaming, social media, social networking, and videos. All right, so they would not share the Wi-Fi password with me, so we're going to log in the old-fashioned way. That's okay. That is always a crowd favorite. I think we like it because it brings us back to a simpler time. You know, like, so we used to get those 99 free hours discs, and like you'd get a whole list of phone numbers, and none of the phone numbers would work. And you'd go down that list, and you finally got a phone number that worked, and then you'd finally connect, but you wouldn't tell any of your neighbors because you didn't want them to use the phone number. And then you finally logged on and someone like picked up the phone in your house and then it disconnected. And then you'd have to make like a proclamation, I am going online. No one picked up the phone, right? It's a whole to do. And you'd finally get online and like there was nothing to do. There was nothing. Like you could play chess with someone in Russia, but that was like the extent of it. And we felt like we were promoting like international alliances by doing so. But what's remarkable is there was a certain menuchas hanefesh that we had back then that we don't have anymore. There was a certain peace and calm that we lived with that we just don't have it anymore. And I think that's really why people like that. It reminds us of that time and some of the challenges that we are dealing with today. So in reviewing some of the impacted domains, let's just see if I did this right. Okay, so in the impacted domains, we see behavioral, social, psychological, day-to-day, and developmental. These are areas that we are seeing kids being impacted by, and it goes from the behavioral as well. So let's start with behavioral. We see dependence, we see distraction, we see impulsivity, disinhibition, and sleep. These are core areas of the behavioral piece that we are concerned about. 20% of kids admit to having emailed or texted something that they later regretted. That was here, by the way. 20% of the kids have done so. And what we also find, and again, this is not here, but more than half of adults have posted messages later. We had 22% report doing so weekly. So you might want to be a little, you know, self-reflective of one's own behaviors as it relates to technology. So there's something about the digital realm that promotes impulsivity. I'm more likely to just send something out quickly without thinking about it. When I was a kid, if I was angry at someone, you know, I was told, you know, write a letter, put it in an envelope, wait a week, and then by the time you're ready to send it, usually the issue's resolved itself. But today, with technology, if we're angry about something, we post, we blog, we tweet, we comment, we iMessage, however we can get our message out there, and we don't think about the potential consequences. And our children are growing up in this environment of impulsivity when it comes to technology. And the question also becomes, what are we modeling for them as parents? Do we, like when we're angry about something, do we say, oh, I'm gonna, you know, they see what we do. They really do. My wife's a kindergarten teacher, and she sees, you know, kids would have those wood blocks and they would build with them, and now the kids walk around like their cell phones, you know, and they're doing this. My wife did a Mother's Day program where she did Mother's Day cards, and it was like, my mommy likes to, and fill in the blank. And so some said, my mommy likes to cook, my mommy likes to clean. I'm no gender stereotypes, just this is what the kids said. But what was amazing was one kid goes, my mommy likes to Instagram. And so the question is, and she goes, okay, so she put it on the card, and the mommy was very proud that her daughter, you know, knew that she liked Instagram. So our kids, even at that young age, are watching us, and we need to model appropriate behavior. The behaviors we want to see in them, we certainly have to model. Online disinhibition, we mentioned that a couple minutes ago. It's behavior and language that's inconsistent with our personal values and standards. When we think about technology, something about the digital realm that makes us more likely to do or say something that we wouldn't normally do or say in a face-to-face conversation. It's just the nature of the digital realm. It's not a new concept. Anyone who took Psych 101 learned about Stanley Milgram, you know, the post-World War II obedience studies with the electroshocks. And what they found was that people tend to be obedient, but a secondary finding of the study was that when people were made to be anonymous, they delivered longer, stronger, even fatal shocks. And so there's something about that anonymity, even if it's not pure anonymity, by the way. People tend to think, well, if I use an anonymous screen name, then I would misbehave. But the reality is, if I were to even send you an email from Ellie@ellieshapiro.com, you know who it is. There's really no pure anonymity. But I'm still more likely to do or say something than I would just because it's through the medium of technology. And so understanding that role that plays with kids is important. Sleep. 51% of your kids sleep with their cell phones or devices within reach. So it's 51% of the kids that have devices, not 51% of the total. 51% of the kids that have their own devices sleep with them within reach. Why is that an issue? Sleep time, it actually impacts sleep. Why do they tell you they need a device next to their bed?
The alarm clock,
right. So the kids have gotten together. They said, okay, this is going to be our position on this issue. Our parents are going to want to take our devices away, but we're going to agree. We're all going to tell them the alarm clock, right? Right. Alarm clock. All in favor, say aye. And that's what has happened. So it's the alarm clock. But the impact that it has on sleep is tremendous. Kids are not sleeping well. And believe it or not, it's a fascinating study, the greatest predictor of whether your children will be successful on any given day in school, academically and socially, is the quality of sleep they got the night before. That predicts their full potential for that day. Any educator, any mechanech, can tell you when a child walks into school, if they did not get a good night's sleep, you see it on their face, they cannot deal with any adversity. They cannot deal with any cognitive or intellectual challenges or social challenges. They just are done before they even started the day. So one of the greatest gifts we can give our kids is a good night's sleep, and that starts by taking the devices away from them at a specific time.
Can I just add that?
Please.
As someone that taught in high school kids, when they don't get sleep, will at least sleep through class. Lower than high school, they do not sleep when they're tired. They just get more antsy and more irritable and cranky.
Yeah.
So they don't sleep, so they don't make up for the lost sleep for sleeping.
Shabbos, they sleep for 25 hours. But basically, we see the artificial light from the phones make it harder to fall asleep, right? The studies have been very clear that looking at devices at bedtime not only make it more difficult to fall asleep, but the quality of the sleep is diminished. Harvard University did a study not too long ago where they compared reading an e-reader at bedtime versus reading a book at bedtime. We all know that when you read a book at bedtime, you fall asleep, right? So, and the e-reader actually kept people up later. So these are some of the challenges. Our kids should not be looking at devices a half hour or an hour before bedtime. And that's something to consider when shaping rules within your own home, when creating an environment about technology, understanding its impact on sleep and how that might influence your decisions or not. 52% of kids report going to bed late as a result of technology. Again, these are your kids reporting it. By the way, I just want you to know, so 50% of students, the numbers are always in line wherever I've collected data from. So if it's like 70% of kids sleep with their devices within reach, then it's like 72% of kids report going to bed late. So the statistics, it always reinforces here when we collect the data, 51% of students sleep with their devices within reach, and 52% report not having a good night's sleep. So these are things to think about. One of the best gifts we can give our kids. One thing if you walk away with, just let your kids get a good night's sleep. It really gives them a greater opportunity the next day. Socially, we see digital distraction, social dependence, online aggression, cyberbullying, miscommunication. We see scenes like this all the time. I call it a regression to parallel play, like preschoolers play next to each other but not with each other, and we as adults are sort of doing the same thing. UCLA did a great study with middle schoolers where they measured kids' ability to read facial expressions and social cues. That's really the foundation of social connectivity. Then they sent them to sleepaway camp without any technology. So they got a baseline, and then they sent them to camp, and they measured them again at different intervals. What they found was that after only 5 days, kids' ability to read facial expressions and social cues vastly improved, as well as their ability to form meaningful connections without 5 days without the technology. So that tells us two very important things. One is digital technology is having a negative impact on the quality of the social connectivity of kids, but it also tells us that we can repair it. We can repair it by taking breaks from technology. So if I were to ask you very simply, when do you connect best with your spouse and with your children? When is that?
Shabbos.
Yeah, I was going to say Thanksgiving, but you know, Shabbos as well. Those are good times for family gathering. You know, 3-day Yontif, right? That's too much, right? Yeah, too much connectivity, too much. No, so what we want to do is we want to be able to understand. We can clearly, we're so fortunate as being Shomer Shabbos, we clearly see the qualitative difference when we don't have technology and when we do have technology. In my own home, we do something called going dark for dinner, where there's no technology around dinner time. So again, thinking about how you want to structure things in your own home. So maybe some of the rules you might come up with: 1 hour before bedtime, no technology. Dinner time, no technology. Again, these are all things that we talked about in the beginning. We want to have technology enhance, not intrude. And for the vast majority of us, technology is serving more as an intrusion than an enhancement in our lives. Okay. When we think about the distraction, we go out with a group of friends fairly frequently. We go out to dinner, at a restaurant. So what we'll do is we'll stack our phones, and the first person who reaches for their phone has to pay for dinner. So it allows us to spend more time together in a quality way. The one thing I do is I always invite a friend of mine who's addicted to his phone. So he's been paying for dinner for 3 years and he hasn't figured it out yet. So that's kind of remarkable. But this concept, by the way, of technology being a distraction from human interaction is not a new one. In the book about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, there was a woman named Mrs. Sharstein. She came to meet with the Rebbe, and she wanted to record her meeting with him with one of those old-fashioned tape recorders. And the Rebbe was very clear No, not to use a tape recorder, because the tape recorder will serve as a distraction from the actual conversation taking place. And this is in the 1950s. So it's an amazing thing that even then, in the 1950s, when technology was, you know, more basic, just the presence of a tape recorder would serve as a distraction. Today's research, today's studies, and it's important to know this, the mere presence of a smartphone on a desk reduces cognitive functioning. They've tested kids and adults. This applies to adults. Not even touching it. Not even touching the device. Just its presence serves as a distraction. So if you want your children to study better, make sure there's no devices on the table. If you want to work professionally more focused and be more productive and more efficient, don't have your device there, even if you don't touch it. Even if you don't touch it, it serves as a distraction. So these are some of the areas that we are seeing. Cyberbullying is actually a pretty large issue in the world at large. And I can tell you here, the kids reported only 3% of the kids reported being victims of cyberbullying at some point, which is well below the national average and well below even Jewish day schools and yeshivas average. So that's a really nice, round of applause. It's a really nice number. I mean, not if you're the 3%, it's not nice, but no. But the reality is, from a percentage perspective, it really speaks to a more wholesome environment, even in the digital realm, where we have these issues of impulsivity and disinhibition, which usually is what contributes to cyberbullying. That piece of it, and even seeing that here at 3% is something that is great. And by the way, in the Jewish community, we tend to see higher numbers than in the general population, which I see your faces are shocked about. It just happens to be we fetch a little more. So we tend to be a little more, whatever. So it just, but it, the reality is it's our own perspective and our own paradigms of our experience that make something real. So that's what we're seeing. So psychological, so we talked about behavioral, we talked about social. Psychological, we see a relationship between anxiety, depression, isolation, addiction, avid cell phone use amongst kids. Kids obviously say, oh, it's so important, it enhances my life, it's the key to my social life, I have to have a device, everyone has a device, you know, all these things. What we actually see is that the more dependence kids place on devices, the higher their anxiety tends to be, the lower their subjective well-being, their happiness tends to be, and they're lower their academic performance as well. So there's a whole host of correlations where if you haven't, when we think about technology, we have to think about the relationship. Some of your kids, all your kids are gonna be different, are gonna have a healthier relationship with technology, and other of your kids are gonna have a less healthy relationship with technology. Some relationships are gonna be more productive and more of an enhancement. Some relationships are gonna be more intrusive and less productive. And knowing each one of your kids individually and how their relationship is. By the way, if your child experiences anxiety or social anxiety or is prone to sadness or melancholy, they are more likely to develop an unhealthy relationship with technology. So think about it in those terms when you are deciding which one of your kids at what age and how much, etc., who is more at risk for challenges with technology. You're going to see different kids differently. This is what we call a hashtag. Everybody familiar with that? The hashtag? For those of you that don't know, it's generally used to file something online. So let's say you went out to a great restaurant and you wanted to, there's that group, Kosher Foodies, great kosher food restaurants. They have about 50,000 users that take pictures of their food and post it. So you would go like hashtag best steak ever or best salad ever or whatever it might be. So that's how you file things. A way of using the hashtag, for example, if you wanted to try it out today, you would go hashtag best lecture ever. At Dr. Eli Shapiro. That's the appropriate way to use the hashtag. And you should, try it out as many times as you want until you get it right. It's gone viral, so you can jump on that bandwagon. So what's amazing is, we tend to think of technology as an enhancement, but we actually do things online that make us less happy. For example, if I flew Delta last night, so let's say if Delta gets me to my destination on time with my baggage where it needs to be, am I more likely to tweet about that versus I got in at 4 a.m. and my luggage is in Hawaii? Which am I more likely to tweet? The negative. So we tend to post negative. We tend to put things up there that are negative. And we tend to read negative news. We're more and share negative news. We see stories about embezzlement spread twice as far, twice as fast, then stories about charitable contributions, just to put it in check. These are, and what this does is it actually creates a negative schema for us, right? We make ourselves miserable. There was a famous study done by Peterson and Seligman, the founders of positive psychology, where they asked individuals to write down five things at the end of the day that they were grateful for. So those that would write down these five positive things, overall, their subjective well-being, their happiness was elevated. They were happier people overall as a result of their behavior. The digital realm, since our default is that we're more likely to share negative or post negative or read negative, we actually are more likely to make ourselves miserable. And if you look even on the quote-unquote kosher websites like Yeshiva World News or Vasas Nayas or Matzev or you know any of these websites, I would say about 80% of the articles are negative. 80%. And so what happens, again, assuming the content of it is kosher, if the content is negative, it actually makes us miserable. So our engagement with technology makes us miserable. A study was done on hashtags, positive hashtags versus negative hashtags, and what they found was for every positive hashtag, there were two negatives. So the research reinforces this idea that we already intuitively know, that we are more likely to engage with negativity online. That's our default. It doesn't mean every individual does that, but that's really our default. If we're cognizant of it and we're focused on it, we can engage in more positivity. And there is a tremendous amount of opportunity for positivity, but the default, again, tends to be negative. 59% of kids, and these are your kids, they reported use technology longer than they intended. It's not surprising. Kids at this age don't have the skills of self-regulation. And so it falls on us as the parents to regulate for them and right and work with them on regulation. Oftentimes what happens is our child will come home and I think most of us have some sort of video game player at home, an Xbox or a Wii or something, and they'll say, oh, can we play, video game? Yeah, okay, you can play for 15 minutes or 20 minutes. And then 3 hours later, we remember we sent them to play video games, and they're like, oh my gosh, right? And then we panic, and right? So this is what we do. We're like, you should have known, get off the video, right? And we panic. And here's what never happens. Thank you, Mom. I didn't realize that the time allotted to me had expired. Thank you so much for bringing it to my attention. I will immediately cease the engagement with the video games. And are there any chores that I can do for you? Right? That never happens. And so I'm going to tell you something to do that's a little counterintuitive, but it makes all the difference in the world. As soon as you realize they've been on playing a video game for way too long, tell them 5 more minutes. Kids need the time to transition. The same way we would. If we were involved with something that we were doing for too long, we also need transition time. So kids also need that. And so giving them that five, of course they're gonna tell you, but I'm in the middle of a level, and et cetera. But at least giving them that 5 minutes, et cetera. But we need to be more conscientious of what we are giving them, how much time we're giving them. Early exposure to graphic violence, inappropriate websites has an impact. And I wanna just share with you, even on these quote-unquote kosher websites with the content like Yeshiva World News, et cetera, the graphic violence that is available to kids, no matter what filter you have, they're going to have access to planes being shot down by missiles, the videos are there, or police shootings, Jersey City videos. Those videos are all posted on these websites. And so we can't just allow our kids, just because it's kosher, give them access. This is very disturbing imagery to our kids, and we should not give them access to that, and we need to be careful about that as well. 43% of your kids have seen an image or video clip that disturbed them. 43%. So, understanding that they are being exposed to things that they don't want to see. Let's see. 41% of kids report that all the devices that are accessible to them have parental control settings or filters. Believe it or not, this is on the higher end of the average for Jewish day schools and yeshivas. The most I've seen in any given community was about 45%. So it's not bad. Statistically, relative to other people, I think. So other people are doing worse than you, but it's not good. Ideally, we should all be at 100%. There's an organization here, Mocaid, that does great work in helping families figure out which filters they should have for their homes. And more important than the filters themselves is you're making a statement about parental expectations. And it's so important. If we just say, oh, we don't want you doing X, Y, and Z, but we don't actually do anything to show that we're serious about it, it's you know, it's as if we didn't say anything.
We actually have a tag office in the school.
Oh, amazing. So is it Mokay/tag? Okay. So it's a great, I guess we can share that information with the parents who don't know. But bring your devices in. They're here to help. They are the technology experts in these areas. Every device, and by the way, it's not just the devices are different. Your individual family needs are going to be different. And so they work with you for your family needs, your devices, et cetera. So I highly recommend it. And it's a great resource. And the fact that it's right here in the school makes it that much more convenient. Day-to-day impact, we see schoolwork, exposure, physical health, criminal charges, college employment, dating, shidduchim, like, are heavily impacted. Actually, Shatan told me a story recently that there was a couple that was dating, and he had sent her a text that he was looking forward to seeing her later. Now, he was texting from, I guess, an iPhone or an iOS device, and she had a different device. And he said, looking forward to seeing you later. And he sent a emoji. Everybody knows what an emoji is? Those are the images. An emoji of flowers. You know, nice. So what came in on her end, the emoji shifted to a gun. Wow. Looking forward to seeing you later. Gun. I didn't make the story up. I was at the Termasara Convention, and he shot from there and told me this story. And so it obviously almost ruined the shidduch. She's like, is this guy crazy? And it was all because of a miscommunication with technology and how that is impacted. But, you know, any of you that have kids in the parsha of dating, you know that you go online and you look up the families. You go to the Simcha Spot or Only Simchas or Facebook, and you try to get, you know, a reconnaissance mission on gathering information. And what you put out there about you, your family, has an impact on what people think of you or see of you and can have an impact. So it's important to realize what we call digital footprints are far-reaching. What you put online, what you say online, creates people's perspectives of you. So for example, another example I give is when you're thinking about, let's say you're a big fan of President Trump, if you are overly vocal online, or let's say you are not a fan of President Trump and you're overly critical online, you're entitled to, it's freedom of speech and all that, but at some point you may come across someone who doesn't share your opinion, and that person may be the one hiring you for a job or giving you an opportunity and say, you know what, this person is too vocal about politics, and I just, right? That's just an example. Politics is an example. But what we put out there has the possibility of really derailing opportunities for ourselves, and sometimes we won't even know about the opportunities that get presented. About 10 students in Harvard 2 years ago had their acceptances rescinded for comments they made in a private Facebook group. So it wasn't public, it wasn't on Twitter, it wasn't, you know, a public, in a private Facebook group, they made offensive comments, and Harvard decided, we don't want these students. End of story. And when you think about kids who get into Harvard, it's not easy to get into Harvard. I didn't get into Harvard. Did you get into Harvard?
Not yet.
Not yet. It's a growth mindset. and if the two of us didn't get into Harvard, it's hard, right? But when you think about kids that are disciplined and focused and academics, and to ruin it for an impulsive, disinhibited comment they made online, so this is a very real impact of the digital realm. So we need to think about it in terms of these day-to-day pieces as well. And I mentioned, so a number of you have early childhood kids, and it's so important to realize this critical stage of development. We see attachment, dependence, self-regulation, learning, all of these are being impacted at this young, critical age of development. The American Academy of Pediatrics, when they make recommendations, under 18 months is to avoid screen time, 2 to 5 years is under an hour a day. These are the recommended screen times, and it shouldn't be surprising, 87% of kids under 5 are exceeding the recommended screen time. So what is that doing to the brain development? It's this critical stage of brain development, age development. What we're seeing is a real negative impact on kids and their development. We see three types of screen time, which actually applies, I think, to all people. We have consumption, that's just watching something. We have complementary, which is really, it's like interactive, but I needed a C word, so it's only complimentary. But it's that interactive, so like gaming, et cetera. So it's not just consumption. There's some interaction going on. There's some brain activity being utilized. And then creative. So not all screen time is equal, certainly for older people. For younger kids, it also can be a challenge. I'm going to show you two short videos. If my thing can work. I lost my... Oops. Let's see.
In many ways, the concern that investigators like I have is that we're sort of in the midst of a natural, kind of uncontrolled experiment on the next generation of children.
Dr. Dimitri Christakis at Seattle Children's Hospital was the lead author of the American Academy of Pediatrics' most recent guidelines for screen time. They now recommend parents avoid digital media use except video chatting in children younger than 18 to 24 months.
So what we do know about babies playing with iPads is that they don't transfer what they learn from the iPad to the real world, which is to say that if you give a child an app where they play with virtual Legos, virtual blocks, and stack them, and then put real blocks in front of them, they start all over.
If they try to do it in real life, it's as if they've never done it before.
Exactly.
They don't transfer
the knowledge from two dimensions to three.
Dr. Christakis is one of the few scientists who've already done experiments on the influence screens have on children under the age of two. It's a critical period for human brain development.
If you're concerned about your teenager being addicted to their iPhone, your infant is much more vulnerable and using the exact same device.
Your infant is more vulnerable because why?
Because the experience of making something happen is so much more gratifying to them.
In a small pilot study that Dr. Christakis conducted on 15 children, researchers gave toddlers three toys. First, a plastic guitar, then an iPad that played musical notes, and finally an iPad with an app that rewarded the kids with lights, colors, and sounds.
So at a very specific time, a research assistant will ask the child to give what they're playing with back.
To give it to the research assistant.
To give it to the research assistant.
Give it to me.
66% of the time, with a traditional toy, the child will do just that.
With the iPad that simulates that, they give it back almost with the same frequency.
Thank you.
But with the iPad app that when they push on it, it does all kinds of things, they're much less likely to give it back.
With a more interactive iPad app, the percentage of kids willing to hand it back to the researcher dropped from 60% to 45%.
Give it to me!
It's that much more engaging.
It's that much more engaging. And that's what we find in the laboratory. In many ways.
So.
We have decades of experience.
Sorry. I actually put this slide together. One more video, just and I think this actually is applicable both to preschool and older. I lost my cursor, so I'm trying to figure this out. Okay.
Babies this young are extremely responsive to the emotions and the reactivity and the social interaction that they get from the world around them. This is something that we started studying 34 years ago, when people didn't think that infants could engage in social interaction. In the still-phase experiment, what the mother did was she sits down and she's playing with her baby who's about a year of age. And she gives a greeting to the baby. The baby gives a greeting back to her. This baby starts pointing at different places in the world, and the mother's trying to engage her and play with her. They're working to coordinate their emotions and their intentions, what they want to do in the world. And that's really what the baby is used to. And then we ask the mother to not respond to the baby. The baby very quickly picks up on this. And then she uses all of her abilities to try and get the mother back. She smiles at the mother. She points because she's used to the mother looking where she points. The baby puts both hands up in front of her and says, "What's happening here?" She makes that screechy sound at the mother. Like, come on, why aren't we doing this? Even in this 2 minutes when they don't get the normal reaction, they react with negative emotions, they turn away, they feel the stress of it, they actually may lose control of their posture because of the stress that they're experiencing. Good is that normal stuff that goes on that we all do with our kids. The bad is when something bad happens, but the infant can overcome it. After all, when you stop the still face, the mother and the baby start to play again. The ugly is when you don't give the child any chance to get back to the good. There's no reparation, and they're stuck in that really ugly situation.
That's a very powerful video, and it's really, it's talking about preschoolers and infants, but it really applies to us at any age when we are with our kids. You know, the question is, are we doing a modified still face experiment when we are on our devices, when our kids are trying to talk to us, tell us something, when we pick them up from school, when they come home from school, what message are we sending? I even give the example, if I were giving this speech with my phone in hand, right, and just holding my phone, what message does that say to you? It's that you are not my priority, that this is what I'm dependent on, and this is what, so what is the message that we're sending to our kids as they get older, whether they're in middle school or high school? Certainly the critical age of development with preschoolers, but even as they get older, you know, I find myself every once in a while, I'll be talking to my child and like just reach into my pocket. It's a compulsion, right? And we don't even realize what we're doing. So we have to be mindful and thoughtful and deliberative of how we're approaching technology use. Sorry, I lost my, give me 1 second, I lost my cursor, so I'll try to get it back. And there we go. Okay. Okay, so let's go back 1 slide. We've learned today so far about social, psychological, behavioral, day-to-day, and developmental issues around technology. So the question really becomes, what can we do? And the first thing we need to realize and remember is that there is no magic pill. We have to approach this in a more holistic fashion. It's not about just device ownership, and it's not about just which filter to get. We have to address device ownership. We have to address filters. We have to partner with our school community in an effective way to do that. But it's really more challenging than that. It's creating an environment at home that is balanced, that technology is not the focal point of the house. It's something that we can use as an enhancement. But the minute we realize that it's an intrusion, we have to take steps to address that. So rule number one that I suggest for addressing technology in the home, rule number one is to have rules. Got to have rules. I know it's a simple concept, but we have to have rules. And it doesn't matter. It's almost secondary. It doesn't matter, but it's secondary what the rules might be. So we talked about some ideas for rules, whether it's no devices an hour before bedtime. That's an idea of a rule. No devices at dinner time. Gaming. What do we do when kids come over to play, right, at our house? Or we send our child over to someone else's house. When I was younger, like if it was someone had a VHS, VCR, can we watch a movie? We'd have to call home, are we allowed to watch this movie, right? And did our parents even want us watching movies, right? So we need to think about this and communicate with other parents in your class. We have, I think, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade parents here. You need to communicate with other parents in class to say what those expectations are, whether it's in my house. So in my house, I may have rules. And when I send my child out, I may have rules. So rule number one is having rules. Rule number two is to discuss those rules, right? Sometimes when we just keep it in our head, our kids don't pick up on it. So rule number two is to discuss the rules with our children, and that it should be clearly understood what the expectations are and what the rules are within any given home. I actually have a rule when we go on road trips. So sometimes road trips are very hard. I live in Far Rockaway, and we go to Toronto. My wife's from Toronto. So we have this like 8-9 hour road trip a couple times a year. And the rule is no technology until we get out of New York City. Now, that could be a three-hour trip just from Farakway to the GW. But that's a rule. And is it a significant rule? There's going to be still another 6 hours on the trip that they have access to technology. But the idea is we're demonstrating there's a time for technology and there's a time for not technology. And we have to inculcate that into our kids. They have to know that it's something that it is to be regulated. And rule number three, which is probably the hardest one, is keeping the rules. It's very easy to set rules. It's very easy to communicate rules. But almost every situation, our children come up with a reason why the rules don't apply to this situation or on this day. You know, it's a Tuesday in January, so the rule obviously doesn't apply. You know, we just had to see Mashah, so obviously, you know, the rule doesn't apply. Or winter break is coming up, so the rule doesn't apply, right? So we have to be vigilant in keeping the rules. The two of the biggest challenges we see from kids is the fear of missing out and bet, which is, but everyone has. But everyone has is not something that is unique to your children. It actually, we see it in monkeys as well.
So a final experiment that I want to mention to you is our fairness study. And so this became a very famous study, and there's now many more, because after we did this about 10 years ago, it became very well known. And we did that originally with capuchin monkeys, and I'm going to show you the first experiment that we did. It has now been done with dogs, and with birds, and with chimpanzees. But with Sarah Boston, we started out with capuchin monkeys. And there's a very simple task that they need to do. And if you give both of them cucumber for the task, the two monkeys side by side, they're perfectly willing to do this 25 times in a row. So cucumber, even though it's really only water in my opinion, but cucumber is perfectly fine for them. Now if you give the partner grapes, the food preferences of my capuchin monkeys correspond exactly with the prices in the supermarket. And so if you give them grapes as a far better food, then you create inequity between them. So that's the experiment we did. Recently, we videotaped it with new monkeys who had never done the task, thinking that maybe they would have a stronger reaction, and that turned out to be right. The one on the left is the monkey who gets cucumber. The one on the right is the one who gets grapes. The one who gets cucumber, note that the first piece of cucumber is perfectly fine. The first piece she eats. Then she sees the other one getting grape, and you will see what happens. So she gives a rock to us, that's the task. And we give her a piece of cucumber and she eats it. The other one needs to give a rock to us. And that's what she does. And she gets a grape. And she eats it. The other one sees that. She gives a rock to us now, gets again cucumber.
So basically, we talked about the social norms influencing what kids want. It's actually interesting, in my daughter's high school, they recently created a policy that the 9th and 10th grade couldn't have smartphones, and they were recommending certain flip phones. My daughter, who never wanted a phone at all of a sudden wanted a flip phone because that's what everyone was getting. So the norms can be influenced by parents and by a school community, and it's so important. Working together and recognizing that there's power in numbers. If there's something that we want for our kids, and certainly regulating technology use, ownership, engagement, etc., it's something that we as a community need to do together. If you're in sixth grade, you need to talk to the other sixth grade parents. If you're in seventh grade, talk to the other seventh grade parents, because the demand that your children are coming home with is based on that social norm. Working with the school, working with the rabbeim, with the teachers, understanding that we can create, today is really one step. It's understanding. Step two is for you guys to get together and say, this is what we want. We want a limit. When I send someone over to someone else's house, I want to know that it's going to be a quality, wholesome experience where we know that screen interferes with the connectivity and the social development. So we want that to be, we need to communicate that with each other. Whether it's apps and social media, You know, not everyone has Instagram, and not everyone has Snapchat, and you can say that as a group, we don't want this. Maximum recreational screen time actually makes a difference. If everybody knows, let's say in an eighth grade class, that technology shutoff, right, or the screen time, let's say technology shutoff is at 8 p.m., right? Everyone in the eighth grade class, or 9 p.m., whatever the number is, it's almost secondary what the number is. If everyone knows that the shutoff is that time, I don't feel that FOMO that I'm missing out, that something's going on that I'm missing out on, and you can actually influence your kids' emotional experience around technology based on creating a norm.
This just happened to me this week.
Oh, yeah?
My son, who's in sixth grade, he told me that one of his friends in class is playing Roblox,
okay,
and they keep talking about who's being what in Roblox, and
yep,
he's dying to play.
This is sixth grade? So I don't know what the percentage of kids play. I actually probably have the data somewhere, but what percentage of kids are playing Roblox, but I think Roblox is rated 12 and up. So if your child's under 12, they shouldn't be.
I also found out that in Roblox you can message people, and I had no idea that was.
So, yeah, I don't want to get, okay, it's a game, but I don't want to get caught up on specific games only because today it's Roblox, and it's Fortnite, it's TikTok, it's, so each one, as parents, the general rule is you got to know what you're giving your children access to, but also if your child's coming home saying that everyone's playing Roblox and I'm missing out, that you should address that. In other words, talk to the other parents and say, hey, do we want our kids playing Roblox? You've informed yourself on what the challenges might be, including connectivity and the dependence, and that it's not even rated for kids under 12 years old. And have that conversation with us. Let's say no Roblox. You know, that's the conversation that a sixth grade class should be having. In working with other schools, this is just an example, by the way, of a school that I worked with that they came up with. The fourth grade, 87% of the parents agreed 7:30 p.m. would be the ideal shutoff time, and 94% of parents in the fifth grade felt that 7:45 would be the ideal shutoff time for technology. That's just a jumping off number. These numbers are not what you have to go by. Maximum recreational screen time, 79% of this particular school's fourth grade felt that 30 minutes was appropriate, and in the fifth grade as well. So there seemed to be consensus even between the fourth and fifth grade. So these are just examples of things that you as a school community, you as a grade can come up with to address that. Yes?
What's recreational technology?
Meaning anything not related to school. So sometimes if a child's doing a school report where they're in front of a screen, I wouldn't consider that, you know, remember we talked about consumption, complementary, and creative. So creative schoolwork is obviously qualitatively different than, you know, watching YouTube. So I wouldn't put that in the same category of screen time. But it's important to be in touch with the school and the teacher. What is the expectation when it comes to schoolwork? You know, if there is there a research expectation that requires online activity? If so, how much time does the teacher expect that this should take? And it certainly should be done with parental involvement as well. It shouldn't just be, okay, here, I always get, hear from parents, well, the school tells my child that they have to do research reports and like they're on the computer for 4 hours. I'm like, your child is not researching the Russian Revolution for 4 hours online. That's just not happening. So, and even kids report, what kids report is that they spend 50 to 100% more time on non-school related activities than school related activities. But the kids are saying it. So as parents, we should really have a better idea if there is an expectation, which I don't know that there is or isn't, but if there's an expectation to do research using a computer, how much time, the same way when you go to back to school or PTA, the teacher says, I don't give more than 15 minutes of math homework per night. If your child is sitting there doing math for more than 15 minutes, just write a little note that they worked on it for 15 minutes. Right? That's the same thing should be with any technology expectation as well. It should be very clear that that is.
Our policy is that teachers don't give assignments that require internet.
Okay. So then that answers that. So then we're only talking about recreational screen time.
And is there any policy about technology in 6, 7, 8, you know?
I know our high school next year already came out with an announcement that they're not allowing any ninth graders own smartphones. They can't attend the high school if they own them. And we are strongly considering a policy for the incoming sixth grade, and the elementary schools are looking to create a policy for the whole elementary school. But I will also say that the high school just had a skiing trip for all those willing to sacrifice their, commit to sacrificing their smartphone for at least a year, and 70 boys signed up for that. So the boys themselves are recognizing that that would be a good thing.
That was what grade?
That was grades 9 through 12, the present 9 through 12. So very soon we'll be talking about this more. In the meantime, we want people to understand the creating healthy habits, whatever. There's still technology around. We're just talking about smartphones, which seems to get kids into the most challenging situations.
I just think if there was a blanket rule, sixth graders cannot have cell phones by the school, it would be very helpful for our family.
Well, they may not bring in cell phones, any cell phones, to the school. We're talking about even owning a smartphone out of school.
Yeah, but if you start later, that's harder.
Yeah, like I would agree. We're definitely going to be phasing that in, so.
I'm comfortable, by the way, throwing this out there, that no kindergartners should own smartphones. Yeah? Does everybody agree? Okay, fine. I'm just going to close with six suggestions for family success and take some individual questions. It's very important to understand your relationship with technology, your relationship, your child's relationship. You have to think about it as a relationship. You know that some of your kids and you as adults also, some of you have healthier and less healthy relationships with technology. You need to be aware of it. Have tech-free time at home. Go dark for dinner. It really made an impact. And by the way, going dark for dinner was something that my own kids suggested. It wasn't like something that, you know, Dr. Ellie Shapiro at the Digital Citizenship Project thought of. It was my my eighth grader at the time. She goes, wouldn't it be nice if we like had dinner and there was no technology and we just like would talk? I'm like, that's a great idea. Why don't we do that? And so we did it. And she's actually very proud every time we do it, like fairly often. I have to say 3-4 times a week. And have personal and family rules. We got to have the rules. We have to communicate the rules. We have to keep the rules. I have a confession to make. When I daven shacharis and I'm wearing tallis and tefillin, I do not have my phone with me. There's a locker that I keep it. No need for applause, please. You're embarrassing me. The good news is that my chakras is down to 6.5 minutes. I somehow managed to do that. But having rules, following them, communicating with your kids about technology, it's so important. You got to be transparent about it. It's okay, you as an adult, it's okay that you have clients and you have a boss and you have things that you sometimes need to respond to. I don't think it needs to be done right in the middle of a conversation, but you can always tell your child, I need to respond to this email, then I'm all yours. So tell them, again, we want to demonstrate there's a time to use technology and there's a time to not use technology, and we want to inculcate those values into our kids. And we need to model responsible technology use. We want to improve dialogue with our children. It's so important that any rules, guidelines, policies that we put in place has to be within the context of a relationship. It can't just be punitive and say, especially if you're, you can't, it has to be, they have to understand that it's part of a relationship. We have trained the middle school and beyond, I think.
Elementary school
in digital citizenship. So they're hearing a lot of the language that we use today. Impulsivity, disinhibition, they're going to learn or are learning this language, and they're going to understand that this is not something punitive. They have a better understanding, more meaningful understanding of how technology is impacting. And so it's really a partnership between school, parents, and your own children on navigating this digital realm. And most importantly, we need to provide balance at home where understanding what our children's experiences are. We can influence those experiences by impacting the social norms, but we need to really, if a child is really having a negative experience, whether having technology or not having technology, we have to really be attuned to it, and each one of our kids are going to be different. I always say that I was brought up as an only child, which was actually very frustrating for my 9 other siblings that I was treated. No, but we have to approach raising our kids as individuals. And I think the hardest part is if your sixth grader is your oldest, it's very different than if your sixth grader is your youngest. Like for my oldest didn't have candy till she was 5, I think. And my youngest, it was like we gave the pacifiers with the candy built in, right? So things obviously change over time, and it's also hard when your older kids are demonstrating relationships with technology are different. But that's all part of the conversation. It's all part of the communication. And the goal really is that if we as a community can communicate with each other, set the rules, set the guidelines, set the boundaries, work with the school community, work with our fellow parents in the class, we can find ways to help our children develop, to grow, to become digital citizens, future-ready, and successful in their future. So thank you very much. I'm happy to take questions, follow-up questions. Yes?
You touched on e-readers just with the study about
yes.
falling asleep at night. Is there really other data about like if it's so much worse than a regular book? And I have two high schoolers that are big readers and push it.
So the research that I looked at was specifically as it related to sleep. I don't know qualitatively if there's more retention or easier recall or if there's more learning via an e-reader versus a book. I'm sure there is research on it. I'm just not familiar with it. I specifically looked at how it impacts sleep. So I'm sure there's a wealth of information on e-readers versus books. I can tell you that there's a large shift towards e-readers and away from books. And you know, as Barnes & Noble continues to go out of business nationally. Yes?
Yeah. They're finding that there is definitely...
I would speculate that to be the case, but I don't...
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm sorry. Okay, I will... Oh, yeah, sorry.
I'm sorry. This is a question not only to you, but to maybe Rabbi Kahneman and Mrs. Berry. But the idea that you brought up regarding making a group of parents in order to control more or less... It's true. If they want something, it's because all the other kids have. But since there's not a lot of parents who feel very concerned, obviously, like we are much more parents than what is the audience today. And how can you work with other parents who don't have always the same wants than
right.
needs that, or referral that I'm not.
So yeah, no. What you're saying is that how do you build consensus within a class when there's diversity and different opinions? So what I have found is that as long as you can get a start, let's say the four immediate best friends of your child, start there. You know the four houses that your son goes to the most. Have a conversation with those other four. Let's come up with three rules that we like as parents. And let's work there. And you can build consensus that way. Start, you get some traction, it can expand. Obviously, what I know a lot of communities have done is just on their own, they'll get together on a Motzi Shabbos, they'll get some sushi, and they'll sit around and they'll talk. I've seen this happen in New York, in New Jersey, where parents were were starting that sort of program and having it, because it was in a more casual environment, the conversation went very well, and they were able to get 40% consensus, 50%, and that really is a great start. Just getting that degree of consensus is a wonderful start to move things in the right direction. I don't think you'll ever get 100% consensus, so that's the simplest, most economic way of doing it. There's a program called MUST in New York, Mothers United to Stall Technology. They offer free support in that as well. In more heterogeneous groupings of classes, when you have a lot of diversity, sometimes you need someone to facilitate that process. So that might be something to consider. But I think having those initial conversations, you know, of the four immediate people, and then you can invite the whole class over to it really requires parents that are motivated and want to take it to the next step to really take those first steps. Yeah?
You mentioned the dinners you have where people put their cell phones in the
yeah.
middle. I've actually seen that in Israel with soldiers as well, like around a campfire. You mentioned your daughter mentioning she wants to have dinner
yep.
with those. What other ways are there to encourage our children to want to live life, like to want to have a life without technology?
Here's the craziest thing you're going to hear me say. Spend time with your kids without technology. I mean, it's exhausting on our end, but like I can't in good faith tell my son not to play video games if I'm not going to go outside and have a catch with him. It's just not right. So I need to dedicate time as a parent to be engaged with my child. That's the way it is, if I want that to be the case. By the way, I will also spend time playing video games with him, because that is a valuable bonding experience as well. You know, he loves playing video games with me. I'm used to playing with this, right? And he is used to playing with this. So it's really not fair. He beats me every time. But it's about the relationship, and it should be balanced, like we said. It shouldn't be only playing video games. But he likes golfing. He's 12 years old. I don't know why he likes golfing, but that means I have to take him to the driving range. And I try to avoid these four-hour, you know, for midwinter break, I'm taking him golfing. That's what he wanted to do. So is that exhausting and costly and, you know, for me? Yes, but that's what being a parent is. Being a parent is exhausting and costly. That's being a parent. So if you're asking me, how do you get them off devices? It's don't use devices as a babysitter just to, you know, keep them out of your hair. And I mean, once in a while, it's okay. But, you know, overall, you have to, it's about the relations, about spending real time, quality time, doing things. And trying to find those opportunities. And I know we live in a very busy world and it's hard, but if this is a priority, then we're gonna find the time to do that. And each one of my kids are different, and you know, I try to make time for each one of them individually and as a group. You know, if we don't want them on devices, then we have to be more engaged, more active, and seeking out opportunities to spend real non-digital time with our kids. Yeah?
My oldest is in fifth grade. We don't have video games at home. Am I going to traumatize them if I don't buy them?
So that's a great question. So the question is, if everybody else has and your child doesn't have, and the answer is, it's different for each kid. Some kids are like, that doesn't faze them, they don't care, and other kids are really hyper-focused on it and it becomes a challenge. One of the difficult roles of being a parent is to choose the consequences of action versus the consequences of inaction. Either way, there's consequences. And it doesn't just apply to technology. It applies to, you know, everything. Where they go to camp, how they spend their off time, you know, what we allow at home, what we don't allow. It's not a technology thing. Technology is very prevalent and it's in the forefront. But we as parents will always need, for girls, we see it a lot with clothing. Although for boys, we're seeing more of that as well with clothing. You know, I want the designer this or the designer that. My son is obsessed with the Adidas tie rods?
Tie rods.
So that we have to make these decisions as parents, the consequences of giving them something versus the consequence of not. So as a parent, you will have to assess ongoing, does his not having a video game device impact him so negatively that the negative consequences of having the device is worth it? And that's just, it's individual per child, per family, per community, per device. So I can't say for certain, but it applies to technology, it applies to other things as well. Yeah?
So we spend a lot of time about concentrating how much time they can spend on it, whether they have devices or not.
Yeah.
We all have situations where they are spending time on devices, mm-hmm. and during the time that they're spending on devices, I find it extremely challenging to control the content of what's there. The filters are very, the ones that we've tried and worked with are very, when we close up too much, the device becomes pretty much useless and they right. can't really expand into researching and doing different stuff. When we open it too much, all of a sudden we walk behind their children and see what's going on, and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, how did that get in there? So how do we take it to the level of, I get everything we spoke about in terms of controlling the amount of time, the importance it has associated with it, and the balance between our lives and all, but there is a particular time that they're on them. How do we deal with that aspect of it?
So that is where Mocade and Tag come in. That's where an organization that specializes in filtering and accessibility with any given device. It happens not to be my area of expertise, and I love when, for me, it's great when I come to a community that has Mocade or Tag, and literally in your own school, which is amazing. Yeah, so it's amazing. I would encourage you to have that conversation with them, show them the devices you have, what your needs are, because your needs are going to be different than someone else's needs, and hopefully that will be effective.
We'll send out an email tomorrow of how to contact them. There's hours that they're here, and there's hours that they're a couple blocks away. There's different hours and places, but
I actually volunteer.
Oh, perfect. So I have a conversation in the back. Thank you very much for having me. Have a wonderful day.
I'm parked on the parking lot.
Yeah, that's me.
Yes, I just got the dreaded call from Robert Grossman.
Thank you so much for coming, everyone. Really, spread the word.
Thank you.
Amazing work.
You're recording.
First.